Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Doing well, doing good, doing great. Very excited. Very, very excited. Very, very excited right now.
I wonder if you're excited for this podcast. Not sure. We are also joined by a guest. We have the one and the only Chris Herring of Sports Illustrated. How are you, sir?
I'm really good, guys. It's good to be back on with you. It's been sometime last year. I can't remember when. It's been at least several months, though. At least 6 months, 5 months, 6 months. What? Yeah, has it been? I don't know.
I think it's somewhere been, last think we did it in May. Yeah.
May? So it's been, was that 7 months? Yeah, 7 months.
A lifetime. Time's a social construct. We're in a pandemic still. 7 months, 7 days. Who knows what it is at this point?
I know. It's bad.
We are glad to have you back. Recording on a Monday night. So by the time this reaches your ears, it will be Tuesday, which means it will be the official release of your book, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. How does it feel to be a published author, sir?
Really strange. I walked into a bookstore today. You know, everybody's got the different stuff that it's kind of the moment for them. Some people, it's your publisher sends you a box of your own books to be able to give to friends and family and stuff like that. So they send it to you. So for some people, it's that moment where they open the box of their own books. You see what it looks like. You get to touch the book and open it and feel it. You know, for me, I was kind of like, I really wanted to go into a bookstore and see the book on a shelf for some reason. I feel like that's my moment like that. But I don't live in New York. So you've got to do it. Like if you try to do that in Chicago, you might see a couple copies of the book. By the way, I didn't even look because I know, first of all, I had to leave for New York before the book was officially out. So if I was seeing it in Chicago, it would have been because like Barnes and Noble has gone rogue and just like started selling the copies on their own. And in some cases, like they have whole walls and shelves and stuff like that, where it's just the book. So I've seen pictures of that, but you know, you're not going to see that in Chicago. So I was like, well, let me just wait till I can see the real thing. And so I've been here in New York for the last couple of days. And since Barnes and Noble has just said, F it, you know, we're just going to sell the thing before it's out. I've gone into two different stores and it's pretty surreal because you go in and, you know, you always, when you walk into a bookstore, at least a Barnes and Noble type bookstore, they have the tables right in the front that have like the biggest titles on sale or the biggest authors or the best known authors right there in front because they're assuming like, oh, this is what you came in here for. And in the two Barnes and Noble stores I've gone into since I've been here, and Lower Manhattan, they both had my book literally in the center of that table. It's the first, when you walk in, if you walk on a straight line, it's literally right in the center of that front table. And that's, that's like, I don't have words, just humbled and excited and nervous and a little bit emotional, honestly, you know. I just think about my parents and how proud they would be. And my sister the other day called and she saw the whole thing with Spike Lee posting a copy of the book on his Instagram. And she called me the next day and she started breaking down, just saying like, you know, how mom and dad would just be like wildly proud. And she was crying, thinking about how proud it would make them because she's really proud. You know, my sister who's younger than me. So, there's just a lot kind of going through my head and my heart. And, but I'm super, super appreciative of the support. You don't get a book on that table. I don't care who I am or what I'm writing about. You don't get a book on that table without a lot of people pre-ordering that book. And you know, I was trying not to be a pest the last 6 months that my book has been on pre-sale. But I kept saying, every month or so, I would say like pre-orders really, really, really help first-time authors. And that's kind of what I meant, is that when you show up and show out like that, I feel like I'm in church saying show up and show out.
we'll get the flag going. That's fine.
Right. Then we get the organ. But when you support a first time author like that, that's what happens. And it gives other people the opportunity to see the book. So I'm just so grateful. And I mean that wholeheartedly. I'm just really, really grateful.
I will let you do the humble thing, because that is just you at your core. As someone that has read the book, you absolutely deserve to have that front row, front deck. You deserve all the pre-orders you got. It is a fantastic read. As someone that was blessed to check it out a little bit early, dog, if you haven't pre-ordered it, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter now. The book's going to be out. Go out and get it if you can. But seriously, block off some time, get your corner, order some food, like really sit with that book, because it is a lot. And I say that as someone that doesn't have a connection to the Knicks, just want to read about some good basketball stuff from someone that knows how to write about basketball. The book is fantastic. I cannot gas it enough. That is my that's my promo for the book. What was the writing one? How did you decide?
I don't want to let you ask a question without saying thank you to all that, because I remember you got a copy of the book and like not too much later, certainly less than a week, you're like, man, that book was really good. I'm like, when did you even start reading it? Like, you told me when you got it. I didn't even know you started reading it. And then you're like, man, this was incredible. I was like, what? So you just kind of went on do not disturb mode once you read it. But I don't want you to think that I'm taking any reaction to it for granted. And I'm grateful. Thank you.
Akaius, before you ask a question, I just want to say, go get the book. All this praise is well-deserved. It's insane. I, as a 90s baby, couldn't stand this Knicks team and found myself engrossed in how Rolando Blackman was feeling and his emotional state. And I never thought I would feel that way. And he's a all-time player. But man, let me tell you, go read it. Just go read it. Go read it. Like, I want to inject it right into my veins. And it's a lot. I want to go play basketball right now. I haven't felt that way in like 6 years.
There you go. Thank you, man. Thank you. Wow. What were you going to ask, Nikas? I'm really sorry.
I was going to go super basic with it. Like, how did you come to the part? Like, how did you decide you wanted to write a book? Like, how, what was that like?
I didn't. a literary agent approached me, and that was a blessing, because Jonathan Abrams, who's a 2-time New York Times bestseller, he writes for the New York Times. Honestly, when he writes, is one of the best feature writers in the game. He wrote a book called Boys Among Men. It was about players making the jump from high school to pro and kind of the stories behind those guys and how they went about doing it. Kobe, Bron, Kevin Garnett really was featured at length in that book, but also a lot of the guys that kind of failed in their effort to do that. I guess the literary agent who now is representing me on this book and my agent for this book, his name is Daniel Greenberg. Daniel was very smart. I mean, like with anything, if you're a writer, you're going to want to know what sorts of things might, you know, if you're a freelance writer, you might want to know what sorts of things news outlets are looking for story-wise. It's kind of a natural thing, because like, if you can pitch that and you can write a good story on it, then you'll have more work in the future, because you got to have your ear to the ground with regards to what these outlets want. Daniel was essentially, my literary agent was essentially doing that with book publishers. Like, what sorts of pitches would be appealing to you guys? So when I bring you this pitch, you'll open up your wallet and want to put out a bid on whatever book is available. And what he kept finding was that the book publishers really, really wanted stuff on the 90s Knicks, which might seem weird. Maybe not, depending on when you're talking about, but like, this was before The Last Dance. So it wasn't like, oh, The Last Dance was really popular, so let's do this 90s Knicks book. I started doing this like a year or two before that. So, but the thing that Daniel, I think, very wisely picked up on is like all the book publishers are headquartered in New York. So a lot of the people that run the publishing houses are Knicks fans naturally anyway. The Knicks haven't been good in a really long time consistently, you know, in 20 years. So there's a huge nostalgia that's built up for those teams, where you talk about it and you like see this look on people's faces, or you talk about it and you hear people do this deep sigh about how sad they still are that they didn't win. And the publishers are among those groups, you know, that, and so he basically heard it from 2, 3, 4 book publishers that they would be really, really enthused about bidding on a book about the Knicks from the 90s. So it then became a task of him trying to find an author to do it. And that was where Jonathan Abrams, he reached out to Jonathan. He'd worked with Jonathan on one of his books, on the Boys Among Men book. And he basically said, like, who would be a good writer to take on a project like this? To my knowledge, Jonathan's like, oh, I want to do it. I want to do it. But he was already working on like 2 or 3 books. And so Daniel was like, you don't have the bandwidth to do it. You're working on too many things. And at the time, I think he was working on, I think the Wire book was already out, but he's working on other projects. So he realistically couldn't do it, but he wanted to. So he was like, give me a couple names. And the first name that he gave Daniel was mine, even though me and Jonathan have only talked maybe like a time and a half in person once, you know, for 5 minutes at most. And then the other time for like 2, you know? And so really we've never had like a full fledged conversation where I really got to know him. We've never hung out. And I think all he knew was like my reputation from those Knicks years where I covered the Knicks for the Wall Street Journal. So I was super honored that he would even bring my name up. And he asked if it was okay to kind of pass my name along to Daniel. And I was like, sure. But I didn't take anything from that, you know, really thinking that I would do it. When Daniel laid out the explanation for why he thought it was a good idea and that he wanted me to do it, I said no the first time. And then he kind of came back around and I essentially said no again. And he was like, what's your hang up? And there were a couple things, like my dad had just passed away a couple months before. And I was, you know, I think mentally I was okay. I was just like, you know, I didn't feel like jumping into anything, which I think is perfectly okay to feel that, you know, after a major loss. I'd lost my mom 10 years before that. So, you know, I just wasn't really ready to throw myself into anything. You know, it's hard to try to do that and work and cover the league at the same time and actually be informative in a way that, you know, to the standard that I normally hold myself to. So, you know, I just didn't really know if I wanted to do it. And the biggest thing I would say, though, is that covering something like that, an era where you really want to dive deep, the undertaking is just so much. And so I was only 4 when they hired Pat Riley to coach the team. That's the other thing. So, you know, realistically, can I do this? And I asked, basically my holdup was, if I'm this young, how can I write about a team that happened that many years ago? And so I talked to Jeff Perlman, who's done 9 books, 7 of them have been bestsellers. And they've basically all been teams that were like ahead of his time or that he didn't cover in person. I don't think he covered any of these teams in person. And he was like, I mean, there's no trick. You just have to really research the heck out of it. You got to talk to every person that was ever involved with the organization, not just the players, not just coaches, not just executives, like through down the line of like the marketers and the secretaries to the executives and the community outreach people and, you know, the psychologists and the lawyers that work for the teams and every like dancers, everybody. You pick up a media guide, you literally go through everybody that works for the organization, top to bottom. It had the scorers, everybody. And I was like, that sounds like a lot, especially when I'm writing about an 8-year span. But that was what I did. And that was why it took, you know, better part of 2.5-3 years for the book to come out after the deal was announced. I did agree to it. I think part of it too was like, you know, I wasn't married. I'm still not married. I don't have any children. So I'm never going to have more of a free opportunity to do something like this. Now, granted, I did lose a relationship over the course of writing the book, which is, you know, probably part of what the cost was. You kind of have to isolate yourself a lot to get something like this done. But it was the right time for that probably anyway, too. But it takes a lot out of you to do this, but I'm so happy that I did it. There might have been a time where I wouldn't have admitted that, but it's hard. And then, you know, it's a hard process, but that was why I said no, because I knew that was going to be hard. But I'm glad I came out of it, you know, on the other side, and at least hope people enjoy it. I at least hope it was worth it from that standpoint for other people to read it.
Well, you guys got a couple of fans here at the very least with what you've read. I tell you that, but
thank you.
Who's been the coolest person that has endorsed the book so far?
Spike Lee No offense to anybody else that's endorsed it, but
oh no, no, yeah, this is how we're doing the pod. If you praise one person, that means it's slander for everyone else. That
right? No, I mean, before that, I guess I would have had to think about it, but no, I mean, he. So I'll tell you really briefly how that happened. Spike Lee on Wednesday, I think it was. Was it? It was Wednesday. Posted a picture of my book on Instagram. I don't really even use Instagram for the most part. I've got one image and it's just me promoting my book. So that's all I use it for. And I've only used it once. Spike posted this picture of him holding the book on Instagram. And a few people brought it to my attention. And I was like, I, you know, saw it. And that was one thing. Then I read the actual post. And I was like, this man called me Brother Herring. And it might as well have been like them calling me Sir in England. Like they might as well have knighted me. Like this is the black equivalent, the black American equivalent, at least. Spike Lee calling you brother is being knighted in America. So I saw that, which that was already amazing and an honor, because I mean, it's like, this is Knicks fan number one. And I don't, you know, I don't even know if there's a two or a three behind that. This is like Knicks fan number one. So there's that part of it. There's who he is, just as far as like the stature of who he is. And then on top of that, it gets back to like later the next day. So Thursday, my book editor text messages me. And you know how if someone sends you like an attachment or an image or anything that's not actual words, you don't see, like it doesn't come up the same way. Like you get a preview message for like what they said, if it's words. He didn't send me words, so I didn't get a preview like that. So I didn't see the message for a while, but then when I looked through my text, I saw I had one from him and it said audio message. I'm like, I don't know what this is. But then I hear he'd like taken an audio clip of it. He's like, yeah, this is Spike. I'm at such and such and such and such. Okay, bye. And I was like, okay, so Spike called you? And he's like, yeah. And I tried to call him back and like, I missed it. Like I'm kicking myself like for the rest of my life that I missed a call from Spike Lee. So this is my editor saying that. And, you know, he doesn't know why I called him. But then I look at my other text messages and I'm like getting blown up by people from high school and I'm trying to figure out why. It turns out that one of Spike Lee's assistants that like works for him either in an office or just as a personal assistant is someone I went to high school with. So the person I went to high school with, who I haven't had touch with for like 15 years at least, and even then we weren't like tight by any means in high school. But she, I guess, you know, for people that follow me, I've been really annoying the last several days because I've had to promote my book. I've had to retweet it. I've had to post pictures. I've had to quote tweet people. It's not necessarily fun, but I also want people to know how appreciative I am of them buying the book and not just buying it, but pre-ordering the crap out of it, as we were talking about before. So in her seeing, I guess, like my repeated posts of these things, she keeps seeing this Knicks book pop up. And I guess it prompted her to ask, Spike, do you have this? Have you seen this? Did you know this was a thing? He looks at her phone or something. He's like, find me that. Like, go get that. It basically was like making the band Diddy. Like, it might as well have been asking somebody to, you know, to find you a midget holding some balloons, if you guys remember the reference, or Cambodian breast milk or whatever else. Man, I missed that show. Anyway, so she has to then like go find the book, which is not out yet. Still not out, you know, at this very moment. But she calls my publisher and like begs, asks, like, is there any way I can get a copy of this book? I work for Spike Lee. They're like, oh, we can hook you up with one. She gets one. Right. Very funny how it works. She runs it back to Spike. Spike starts reading immediately. This is Wednesday. That was when he posted the picture of the book and referenced me as Brother Harry. The Knicks had a game that night, which, you know, you guys know Spike sits courtside for every game. So it was a home game. Spike got back that night and finished reading it before he went to bed. So he got the book in like late morning, started it, went to the Knicks game and then finished it before he went to bed. Like, he read it all in one day. And I guess probably two sittings. And then that was why he called on Thursday, was that he wanted to connect with me. So when my phone was blowing up, aside from my editor suggesting that Spike tried to call him, did call him, I had people from high school, that assistant who isn't that tight with me, but went to my high school, was reaching out to a bunch of different people from my high school who she figured might have my number, like mutual friends of ours. That, and so they were like asking, is it okay that I, you know, pass your number along to her? And it, she keeps saying it has something to do with Spike Lee. I'm like, oh, she can have my number then. Yes, please. So Spike called. We talked for 2 hours. And I mean, he was asking me all sorts of questions about the book. Yeah, it's just surreal. All of it is surreal. But anyway, I sat courtside with him the last couple of games, one on Saturday, one on Sunday, I mean, between Georgetown and St. John's, then Charlotte and the Knicks on Martin Luther King Day. It's all just very, very, very surreal. I mean, he's doing an event with me on Wednesday now, which was done on short notice because something came up with Zach Lowe. So it's just super, super surreal. But obviously, there's no endorsement that's coming from anyone. I mean, if Barack Obama wants to read my book, I can get him an early copy maybe too. But even if that happens, like, I still don't know if it's like more substantial than Spike Lee as it relates to Knicks fans. So it's, yeah, I didn't think that endorsement was coming. It's funny because I was talking to my publicity staff several weeks ago about a potential Spike Lee event and the idea that, like, let's reach out to his people and maybe we can do something, like, you know, Spike had a book come out in like a photo book, like coffee table book come out in like November. And I was like, maybe we can buy, you know, several copies of that, you know, and the publisher, like our publisher, will eat the cost of it. And then we can both, you know, promote our books together. I'm sure he'd like to talk Knicks. He doesn't know me, but because he doesn't know me, we can do something that's kind of seen as a favor to his side. And maybe we can get him to do an event with us. And my publicity staff was like, oh, yeah, sure. Like, they didn't say no, but I'm pretty sure they didn't look into it either. And so now the fact that the man read the book once and, like, now wants to do events and was asking me, can he be, like, kind of delegated to do events with me, for me? I'm just like, what just happened? Like, it's Nikaz asked me right before we started recording, like, what have the last few days been like? And it's like my head's spinning. And that's the most, I'm grateful and will always be super grateful. But I'm also just like, I don't know what I've ever done to kind of deserve this level of support or excitement from other people. Cause it's just, it's weird. I can't get out of my own head from that standpoint, but That's been my last few days, and it's just weird and crazy and awesome.
Now you put the work in. This is a well-deserved victory lap. Overly well-deserved. Also, unpack the Instagram post. There's a power ranking of things that just happened in your life with Spike Lee. This man demanded the book and read it in one night. Andy said courtside. Salute!
Called you Brother Harry. Like, that's
Brother Harry. I mean, I still don't know that. I have to sit courtside with the man for the next 10 years, but he called me Brother Harry as far as I'm concerned. Like, I don't know that courtside seats outrank Brother Harry. Not when you feel the way I feel about Malcolm X. And, like, yeah, nothing will ever top that as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, man, that's awesome, man. Couldn't happen to a better dude, genuinely.
Thank you.
As far as the book goes, again, it's great. Let me just say that outright. It's great because there are some stories in here. There are a lot of stories in here. Some Anthony Mason stories, some Rolando Blackman stories, some Pat Riley stories. I have no idea how that man was not in prison for some of his practice regiments, but that's a whole nother thing. What was the most difficult story for you to chase in this book?
There were a few. I keep getting this question, and I'm not annoyed by it, but I just think it lacks some of the nuance that I think I had to take with it. So I mean, yeah, Anthony Mason was always going to be a challenge to write about. He's not here anymore. He passed away in 2015. He's one of the more beloved Knicks from those teams. And like, it's well documented that he was really notorious off the court, on the court too, but really off the court, that he just kind of lived a wild life and lived a really fast, wild life. And I told myself, and I've said this a couple times, I might have said it the last time I podcasted with you guys about the book. He's not a cartoon, you know, like he was a person. So I get the impulse for everybody. Like, people have been saying, like, oh, you definitely got to the bottom of that Biggie story to tell anecdote, right? Like, that was Mason that was in that song that Biggie rapped about, like about the Nick that, you know, and I was like, okay. So I definitely asked the question several times to different people. Like, I don't know that people can fully realize how awkward it is to, I mean, and it, like, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to ask it, but like how awkward it is to ask the women that Anthony Mason has, like, to some extent built lives with from the standpoint of like having a child with them, to then ask them about whether, do you think Mace was the person that Biggie was rapping about? Like, did you have relations with Biggie, like behind Mace's back? Like, to some extent, do people realize that that's what I'm asking, in effect, when I'm trying to get to the bottom of that rumor? So it doesn't mean I don't ask it, but it's uncomfortable. And so it's like, I think the point I'm making, though, is that I don't think people fully appreciate that point, first of all. Secondly, it doesn't somehow reduce how wild he was without having that. Like, I mean, Nikias, you had a chance to read it all the way through. Like, that chapter has some real, like, deep cuts as far as, like, some stuff that was really, if you want to call it, like, I don't want to reduce it to bro code, but, like, some stuff about as it related to, like, his teammates and his teammates' wives that maybe Anthony Mason was involved in that, like, is not kosher from that standpoint. Like, to me, that's kind of more crazy than the stuff about the Biggie accusation or the Biggie intimation or anything else. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just like trying to justify the idea of not having that detail nailed down. But the other thing is that I asked several people that were really close to him about it, and most of them, like, basically were saying no. And the few that were saying yes, it did happen, or yes, he was that guy, wouldn't have actually, like, I didn't get an impression that they actually knew. And I'm not sure they would have known more than the people that said that they didn't. So I let it go at a certain point. Like, it's not my job to deny a rumor over the course of a book. Like, if the rumor were true, then sure, you print it. If the rumor, if you can't prove that something ever happened or that he was the person, like, and I would only be reacting to stuff that was based on something that we, if you're still looking at me to figure out whether it's true, then you can't use the other stuff to justify putting in the book if it's not true. Like, it's kind of where I sit. But anyway, so that was something like I definitely chased. There was, I've said this one before. This is the funniest one or the most interesting one that I was really disappointed because I thought I had it and then it wasn't a thing. Somebody very prominent from the team at one point told me that Richard Nixon had come to a game, which he did, that the Knicks were in the midst of a long winning streak, which they were. And that Richard Nixon was there and they wanted Richard Nixon to come into the Knicks locker room after the game and take pictures. And in my mind, I'm like, why would you want to take pictures with Richard Nixon? But anyway, so he's there, but then the Knicks lose and then their win streak is broken. So, you know, so the team is not in a great mood when Richard Nixon comes in, but they've already agreed to have him come in and take pictures. So the players are like, whatever. Patrick Ewing is apologetic. Like, he gets out of his like ice bucket that he's always sitting in right after the game ends in his full uniform. He stands up to greet the former president and he apologizes to Richard Nixon for the fact that they've lost the game because they normally win and they've been on such a long winning streak at home. And the story I was told is that Richard Nixon, he was there because he was bringing his grandson to the game. That Richard Nixon grabbed Patrick by the shoulder and said, well, Patrick, that's okay that you guys lost, but in the future, if you can't beat him, cheat. And I was like, I don't remember exactly what I was thinking, but part of me was like, okay, the process of making this book like a bestseller will become way easier if that's accurate, because all of a sudden, yes, Knicks fans will want to buy the book. maybe you get some people that are just general interest fans. There are going to be a lot of political people picking up this book if we put that out as a blurb or like in an excerpt, or if we just kind of sift out the fact that like this is in the book too. Historians would really seize on that, because granted, it would have been unjust, obviously, or just kind of self-deprecating. But I don't know that Richard Nixon's ever been on record like joking about the nature of his impeachment, or not impeachment, but his resignation. So like that would be picked up by a lot of places. And I'm sure the level of interest would be a lot different from certain places if it was true. So as soon as I got off that phone call, I was like Googling, like, when did Richard Nixon go to a Knicks game? What date was this? I'm just trying to check some aspects of like the details. And within 5 minutes, I found that like not only did Richard Nixon only go to like one game, so it was pretty unmistakable that it was that game. It was against the Minnesota Timberwolves, and the Knicks won by like 25 or 30. And I'm like, dog, like, is this whole anecdote just BS then? And so then I went back to the person, because the person had made it sound like he was standing right there when it happened and everybody saw it. And I went back to the person like the next day, next week. And I'm like, what's this here? Like, come on, bro. Like, tell me there was another game or like another scenario. Like, tell me that you mixed it up. He's like, I could have sworn I read that somewhere. I'm like,
oh,
I was so disappointed. Cause I'm like, that detail would have been so good. And I would have like dressed that detail up so well. I was so disappointed, but so I really wanted to run with that detail, but like, obviously if you can debunk it that quickly, and that's my fear. And it was a good thing that it wasn't real, that it didn't happen, because it's a good reminder just to really stay on your toes. You got to like verify everything. And that obviously did not happen. And if I can debunk that quickly, like I can only imagine, like, can you imagine if I have that in the book and then these historians start reading the book and they debunk it within like 2 seconds? Who, you know, were anything about a former president and their whereabouts and being in a public setting, they would be able to debunk that like that, especially with the win streak detail and everything that wasn't true, or that, you know, that they didn't lose at least. So anyway, I say all that to say that there is that. There are plenty of things that I'm trying to think anything else that I didn't get. That was an example of something I really would have liked to have had. No, not really. You know what I tried to do? I mean, to answer your question in a different way too. I tried for every major thing, you know, Starks' Game 7, which there's an excerpt on Sports Illustrated about, really digging into what happened on that night. Pat Riley's exit for Miami and kind of the backroom dealings of that. The 97 series against Miami where the PJ Brown suspension happens. Or the PJ Brown, Charlie Ward kind of scuffle happens, and the Charles Smith sequence and the whole Charles Smith chapter, really all of it. I tried to put details with every one of those stories that were like kind of stuff that had either never been out there or that had never kind of been explained to the extent that I did. And that was my goal, was like every major, major moment, you know, even Patrick Ewing shattering his wrist and as it relates to Milwaukee and all the bad luck he had against Milwaukee, I needed every big moment to have kind of unprecedented context and detail. And that was what I went for. So most of the things I really wanted to outline and illuminate, I was hoping there would be more when it came to Michael Jordan and the allegations or the rumors that he was really close to signing with the Knicks in 96. I would have liked to have had more on that, but there was nothing to it. Like, it wasn't real. So, you know, I guess I was at least able to debunk that, but it would have been cool if there had been a little bit more to that. You know, there just isn't anything. So I don't, you know, I guess that was the one thing I went in hoping that I would have more on, but can't make something up. So, or at least I can't.
Makes sense. On a similar note, was there something that you did nail down that you couldn't put in?
I don't know if it's like nailed down as much as like there were places where I didn't use names. I really want to not name someone, but like lay out who I'm talking, like what I'm talking about. There's something pretty early on that I mentioned that I just kind of run right past without mentioning a name. There's no purpose to, but like I remember kind of doing like one of these when I learned who it was. So, I mean, there are things like that. The way I viewed it, you know, and there are other things too that were, you know, you'd hear a name connected to something, or they tell you that this person really was about this, or they really did a lot of that, or, you know, a player that tells me that he was the guy that kept condoms or would take the leftover condoms from players when they got back from the road, because he was one of the few guys that wasn't married. You get stuff like that. I remember, like, in the very first version of my book, I had stuff like that in there. And then it was like, it wasn't building toward anything. It didn't really help explain anyone or anything. So to me, it felt gratuitous. So I would just pull it out of this story. I took it out of the book. And it's funny because, like I say in the book, even at the end of the prologue, I think it's a book that pulls no punches. And rest assured, that's how those Knicks would have liked it anyway, because they're, you know, a rough and tumble team. But I think there's a difference between, like, not pulling punches and that, and like also just including stuff just to include it. And I've read books like that where, like, you don't care who you hurt and you don't really care what the context is, you just run with it. And I don't want to, like, I've never been that person. Just because you know something doesn't mean you use it. It has to serve a purpose. And I think in a lot of cases, I would look at when I had stuff like that and it was like, this doesn't serve a purpose. I'm not trying to end marriages. It doesn't make the book any better. It doesn't necessarily help you understand this person any better. So at that point, you know, and to some extent, I think having to write about Mason was helpful from that standpoint too, because, you know, what I kept hearing from one of the women that he was with, Latifah Whitlock, who he had Antoine with, Antoine Mason, she kept telling me, look, I know I was with him for a long time. So, like, I know what a lot of his flaws were. I'm not asking you to make him an angel. I'm asking you to not, essentially, to not make him a cartoon. Like, he had depth to him. He had character to him, you know, good and bad, but, like, he had character. And I can take whatever it is you have to say, but, like, be fair, more or less. That's the level of trust that you get. And so there's really no reason not to, do that with everybody. You know, I felt a special responsibility to do that for Mason, but, like, with everybody else, just because you know something, if it's not helping you understand anything, like, there was one page, really, I would say maybe a page and a half of viewing stuff that brought up some infidelity and stuff like that. That was fine. And it was that interesting. Spike actually asked me about that. He was like, did you give thought to not including maybe some of that stuff? You know, someone that is friends with Patrick. And I said, no, I actually didn't have that much thought about that. You know, I mentioned in one portion of the book that his marriage, you know, blew up after it became known that he had an extramarital affair with a dancer in the middle of a season. It came out with a Knicks team dancer. And so that came out, I think, a month later. You know, his wife of 7 or 8 years had started divorce proceedings. And then I mentioned, and this was, you know, from my own reporting, not from stuff that was out in the media, that, you know, later he would have a relationship with another dancer, with another team dancer. So, you know, I mentioned that in there, and I mentioned some other details like that. And he asked, did you give thoughts to not having it there? And I said, well, no, not really, because I think it says that, you know, that he had access to the team dancers and didn't shy away from that. Even once that kind of, you know, and who knows, maybe once he was single officially, maybe there's nothing wrong with it. But there was something that I basically put in there about the fact that, and this is probably as far into that hole as I would go, or like into the weeds as I would go, that the team dancer that I spoke to said that she and Patrick would never use his actual bedroom that he shared with his previous wife, which she took it to mean that, like, he still wasn't over that, or he still wasn't ready to let anybody into that space based on the fact that his marriage had ended. And she took it to be like a certain sadness that he felt, or just kind of like that he couldn't mentally go there. So I did include that because I actually felt like it illuminated something about the fact that he realized that there was something sacred about that, that he'd lost in his marriage. So maybe it sounds like a little bit too pie in the sky about the way I'm explaining all that. But, like, to me, like, that actually is somewhat informative. the other stuff about the idea of like, oh man, like I was the condom man on the team. Everybody just gave me the condom. It was an interesting detail. Certainly, I remember hearing it, like your ears perk up a little bit. But then when you look for a spot to place it and there's no natural spot and there's no natural reason to include it, like, why would you include it? So I wasn't looking to hurt people. I had the book lawyered very carefully after it was written by a lawyer that read word for word. I kept thinking she was going to take that Patrick Ewing page, two pages apart, because it's like, man, this is kind of touching on some personal stuff. She didn't touch that page at all. And I was like, oh, I was expecting, you know, that you were going to have a lot of comments. She was like, it's been out there before that Patrick has been unfaithful. So like, you're not really, even the little detail or two here that you kind of bring out that has never been out there, the general headline there is no different than what it's been before. So, you know, we make stuff like that out to be such a big deal. And, you know, to certain people, it is Patrick, to the people he's been with. But, you know, like I wasn't breaking news from the standpoint that they've been unfaithful before. So, you know, I told Spike the same thing that I just told you, that I think it has to be building and working towards something. And if it's not, then you can make the argument to take it out. But there were things I left out sometimes just because there was no benefit in hurting people. And people could have gotten hurt. And that wasn't my aim, especially if it wasn't helping tell the story any better.
What is, I'll throw this one at you and I can open up to Steve if he has anything. What was your favorite story in the book?
Well, so I had a lot of people telling me, and I knew this from just having researched them a little bit. I knew the team liked to gamble. I knew that. Every team likes to gamble. Every team has money. All the players on the teams have some degree of money. But I knew the Knicks really liked to gamble. And so I kept trying to find ways. I'd ask every player, everybody on the team, what was the gambling like? It's literally like a stock question I had for everybody. They tell me, and people were telling me the alignments of the seats that they had on the plane, who would gamble with who would sit next to whom, finally, I talked to Chris Childs towards the end of the research process, interviewing process, and he starts telling me that Oakley really likes to gamble, which I'd heard that. He really loved to do it. He had a leather duffel bag that he carried 50 G's in at a time on road trips. And what Chris Childs said, which I think, you know, in journalism, a lot of times they use the phrase show, don't tell. Show rather than tell. Meaning don't tell somebody that the Knicks like to gamble. Show them that the Knicks like to gamble through your writing. So Chris Childs tells me that, you know, Oak has the leather duffel bag, but in particular that after a while, Oak started getting really frustrated with the younger teammates that just didn't have the same money. You know, they're not going to be able to gamble with a Patrick, an Oakley, a Starks, Xavier McDaniel, a Mason for that matter, because they don't have it like them. And in particular, a lot of the young guys would just say, I'm willing to use my per diem money. And essentially my lunch money, which was a lot of money for lunch, you know, a couple hundred dollars, what have you, or, you know, for that or for dinner. So they could gamble that. But they're like, I don't have any, you know, I'm not going to go into any more money than that. And plus that's all the cash I have on me. So Oak started getting mad about it. And essentially at a certain point, he got fed up with that excuse of like, oh, I ain't got it today, Oak. Sorry, I can't gamble with you. He brought a credit card imprint, like scanner machine, those old school joints, so that he could start charging his teammates credit cards so that he could essentially tax them, but also rid them of the excuse of not having the ability to gamble because they didn't have the money to do it. And like anybody that goes out of their way to buy a machine, and again, that he was taxing them like 10% on top of the fact that he was having them do that so that they wouldn't have excuses anymore of how to gamble. So like, to me, that one, I think that was like a very clear example. I also think I'm kind of in love with the one about Riley, just because I felt like, to me, if there's anyone in this book, like somebody from the Heat, adjacent to the Heat, the other day told me that he bought the book and loved it, is loving it. And he's like, do me one favor. Can you sign a copy for Pat? I want to give one to him for like a birthday or like Christmas. I was like, are you sure Pat Riley wants a copy of this book? Like, have you read the way that this man is portrayed in the book? Like, I promise, again, I'm not out to make anybody look bad. Like, inherently, Pat comes off as like kind of a lunatic at times in this book. And but you know, the guy says like, no, I know that, but I think Pat takes a certain pride in that. I'm like, okay, I'll sign it if you want me to. I'll sign it to Pat, whoever. But like Pat, so there was the one detail in the book that Dave Checkins gave me. He was the president of the Knicks during those years and later the president of Madison Square Garden. And Dave was telling me that the very first training camp that Pat was in, he and Pat were having lunch. And I guess Dave got a call on his cell phone. And it was, you know, one of those big brick phones. So, you know, aside from it being massive, people 10 states away could probably hear the conversation just because, you know, it's not right to your ear or anything. It's a big brick phone. So Pat is within earshot of what, you know, what is being said on the other end of the phone. It was Dave Checkins' wife who called. And she said, Dave, you know, I'm at the dealership and I'm about to buy a Chevy Suburban. We've talked about this. It's just a matter of like what color I'm getting now. Like, are you okay if I get green? Dave Checkins says yes, but Pat Riley again is within earshot, so he can hear the conversation. And he kind of basically like taps Checkins on the shoulder. He's like, Dave, you cannot get a green Suburban. She can't get a green Suburban. And Dave is looking at him like, why? And he's like, green, that's the Celtics. You can't get green. And Checkins starts laughing, but Riley's not laughing. Riley's completely serious. And so Checkins basically, he's like, all right, babe, sorry. Like, actually, green's not going to work. So then she's like, oh, okay. Even though you were just okay with that a second ago, how about red? And he's like, that's fine with me too. And Riley at this point is like getting color in his face. Like he's like getting red faced because he's like, are you kidding me, Dave? Like, we're with the Knicks. Like, we have to go through Michael Jordan. Like, that's not okay either. That's the Bulls. And Checkins is like, you're being completely serious right now. And Pat is completely serious. And to me, that anecdote says so much because it speaks to how Pat would view anything as being like disloyal or like against the code, basically. And it tells you, and Steve, you were saying right before that you read the excerpt about the game seven of the finals in 94, that sort of stuff comes into play for Riley. And even, you know, maybe I'm giving away too much for people that haven't read the book or gotten a copy of the book yet. There's a very big dispute that Pat Riley gets into in game seven in 94, or not in game seven, but a couple weeks before game seven and the series before that with Rolando Blackman, that the players essentially wonder, and multiple players told me this, Doc Rivers, Derek Harper essentially said this, you know, and Derek Harper played with Rolando in Dallas. They essentially wonder whether Rolando Blackman gets held out of game seven in part because of the fact that he got in a disagreement with Pat Riley one series earlier. And while I personally don't think that Pat would make that decision because of that, you know, you also look like Rolando didn't play at all in that series before that either. But the fact that the players think that Pat might have been vindictive enough to hold Rolando out because of that, I think that the fact that their perception that they think Pat could even view it that way and think that way is noteworthy enough to put in the book. Like, I don't think that, but the fact that they think that it might have been the case, that's incredibly story worthy to me because it speaks to how they view his mindset and how warped he must, like the warped way in which he thinks. So to me, one detail is funny. The other one is really, really informative just from like someone's psyche, in my opinion. So that one I really am proud of just because I think, I mean, I could connect that to like 12 different things as it relates to Riley. But that one I feel like is important. And certainly in that moment, it was important.
Gotcha. Steve, did you have anything?
Nah, like I just want to read the book now. Like I just want to. I'm dead serious. Like anytime you can get to those kind of layers and peel the onion back on the psyche. Like think about it. You just talked about Charles Oakley getting a credit card stamping machine and Pat Riley having that mindset to say, "Nah, you can't get this color." But like that's part of it. That's part of elite athletes and getting to that level. The minds they have and the mindset they have. I feel like it doesn't get appreciated enough. And just reading what I've read and hearing what I've heard, I just want to go read it right now.
No, I appreciate you, man. It was a fascinating team. Like, you know, a lot of people, not a lot, let me not give that much credit to the trolls and stuff, but like some people will say, you know, after we've watched The Last Dance and everything else, like, there's no need. Like, why are we paying attention to the team that never won anything? Okay, fair. Would also encourage you to look at the fact that the Fab Five 30 for 30 is the most viewed one in 30 for 30 history. I think that people, teams that never win can be fascinating. I think that you have to think about how to carry out their story. Like, they had to have been influential in some way. The Fab Five certainly was, without question. I think the Knicks were too, not from like a style standpoint. But the fact that the league, Usain bolted its way away from the way the Knicks played basketball. It was made illegal within like 2 years how they played basketball. Hand checking was made illegal. And Derek Harper, when they would go around and do the points of emphasis meetings, team by team, and send an official around and the league disciplinarian around, they would go with VHS tapes of what was no longer allowed to show it to teams. And Derek Harper, the Knicks starting point guard, was on the film for the first 2-3 minutes hand-checking people. Like, that was the video everybody was seeing. It was Derek Harper doing that because he was the poster child for it. When they got rid of flagrant fouls, when they started penalizing and suspending players after you hit a certain threshold for flagrant foul totals and flagrant foul points, it was the season after Charles Oakley had more than twice as many flagrants as any player and more flagrants by himself than 15 teams. So that was because of the Knicks. The idea that they were going to start, they used to have a dumbass rule where you could swing at somebody, but if you didn't connect with them, you weren't going to get suspended. You only got suspended if you connected on the punch. Like, what sense does that make? So they got rid of that rule. They scrapped it. Like, if you swing at all, you're suspended. That was because of the Knicks, essentially, because the Knicks were in more fights than anybody. They had more technical fouls than anybody. Later on, they presented the rule that if you leave the bench during an altercation, you're going to get suspended. That was because of the Knicks and the JoJo English Derek Harper fight in 94 that happened 15 feet in front of David Stern, who was sitting there at half court with his wife during a Bulls series, watching John Starks and Derek Harper and anybody else tumble into the crowd, into the laps of the daughters of the minority owners for the Bulls. Like, there was money on the table. There was concern about the league's image. You know, this was David Stern, who had the dress code implemented several years later. Like, he cared so much about image, and the Knicks were ruining the league's image from his standpoint. So the Knicks literally ushered like a massive shift into the league. And I think it's actually fair to say we probably don't have the league we have now, or if we do, we don't have it as soon as we got it. It wouldn't have happened as soon as it did without the Knicks playing the way they played. Because essentially what the league said is, and several people told me this, we didn't want physicality and overwhelming physicality to become more important than skill. They were worried that like the Jordan Bulls, not maybe them specifically, but like teams like that that had way more talent, way more skill, we're going to start getting beaten by teams like the Knicks and what the Pacers would become and what have you. Because at that point, you're encouraging those teams that don't have the talent to just bully up and just hit people. And so they did away with that really quickly. You could make the argument again. I think that the Knicks fundamentally changed the sport. Not that they dominated it. I understand that Michael did that. So I'm not a fool. I'm not trying to be cute when I'm saying this, but I think the Knicks changed the sport as far as the way the game was played more than the Bulls did during those years. That's worthy of a lot of attention as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not The Last Dance. They weren't the best team, the most talented team, but like the way they changed the sport and the fact that we're never going to see a team like that again is because of the way they played. So like, tell me how that's not worthy of a book, frankly. A team in the biggest market that almost won twice, that went to the finals immediately after Michael Jordan retired each time, the first two times. It's a team that would have won had Michael not been there at some point. And was fascinating in terms of the personalities that changed the league. Like that's worth it, a book, in my opinion, all day long. So you know, if the book sells the way it seems like it's selling, then that people have kind of ruled on it in their mind that they thought it was worthy of a book. So, you know, whether they enjoy it, I guess, is a different issue. But, you know, like I said, maybe I'm speaking to too many trolls when there's only a few of them. But that, to me, that's a book. You want to know something? David Falk, at one point, I was interviewing him. He was not the kindest. I'll be real. He asked me when I was asking him questions. He stopped me at one point. He was like, "Why are you even writing about this?" And I was like, "I'm sorry." He's like, who cares about the Knicks?" And he said specifically, when I told him I was working on a chapter about Anthony Mason, "Who cares about Anthony Mason? Who cares about the Knicks?" And I said, and I normally, you know, you just let people talk and get out whatever they need to get out. He said that. And I said, "Look, I don't know you personally. I fully understand that you've had success with who you've worked with, that you've worked with someone, you know, obviously we know who I'm talking about, who's accomplished everything there is to accomplish. He's never lost at that level at the finals. But I'm going to respectfully ask you to trust me when I say that there are a lot of people that care a whole lot about Anthony Mason. And there are a lot of people that care a whole lot about those Knicks teams. Like, but again, I do think there are people that adopt that mindset of, if they didn't win, why do they matter? They don't matter. And this is not true. So like I said, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if the book resonates with people, because a lot of people cared about those teams, in part because they haven't been shit since then, if we're being real. And like the nostalgia is strong, but the nostalgia being strong is also part of why The Last Dance did so well. So I was a little bit stunned that he didn't understand that connection of like the 90s matter to a lot of people from an NBA standpoint. But anyway, I'm neither here nor there. But yeah, a lot of people care about those teams. And, you know, I think it's been reflected in the fact that people pre-ordered the book the way they did, which I'm so grateful for.
Yes, we got some David Falk slant on the podcast. We love it. But on a serious note, again, if you have not gotten the book already, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks, please go out and get that if you can. And if you can't, find a way to do it anyway. It is a tremendous read. Trust me on that one. Chris, before you go, can we get you to do some Bulls talk with us?
Yeah, that would only be fair.
Let's dig into, since we're already Bulls adjacent right now with the Falk mention.
I don't know where that came from, why I mentioned it. I probably shouldn't have. Anyway, go ahead.
We found the heart of the podcast. But anyway, the Bulls are 21-16. They have a top five offense. The defense has slid, mostly due to injuries as of late. This is a team that you've written about a couple times this year, one before the preseason, where you dubbed them the most intriguing team in the NBA. You've also written about them again later into the season, more so focusing on what DeMar DeRozan has been able to do. So I'll start here. Like, what did you expect from the Bulls heading into the season?
Honestly, man, I wrote one piece, I think, in August that was a little, I can't remember when free agency happened, but they got Caruso and they got Lonzo and they got DeRozan. And I wrote a piece, you know, could the Bulls be like a home court advantage team in the East? And the Bulls fans loved it. They retweeted the crap out of it. Everybody else was like, when did you start drugs, Chris?
oh, no.
Essentially, not everybody did. I mean, and also I think enough people respect my work to the point where they're like, wow, Herring thinks this. Like, maybe I need to give another look to this team, or at least start thinking about them differently. So I can appreciate that some people said that, but a lot of other people were like, when did you start drugs? So I wrote that, and then I wrote kind of more of just like a down the middle piece, the feature that you're talking about before, in which I essentially compared the Bulls to the Hawks from last year and the Suns from last year, who obviously both teams made deep runs in the playoffs. One made the finals. Hawks almost made the final. It wasn't necessarily that I thought that they were the same thing, but I would say that, like I said, the Hawks were the most intriguing team last year, well before they got on a hot streak. You know, I thought they were intriguing when they went all in over last summer, or, you know, last offseason. The Bulls kind of did that here, maybe not during the offseason, but, you know, the trade deadline last year, they brought in Vooch, they get DeRozan, you know, they're bringing in Lonzo Ball, Caruso is someone that they spent some money to get. So in my mind, in the last year, if you go back to, again, to the trade deadline from last year, they've completely, I mean, the only guys that have been on the roster now for the last year, all the way back to last year, are Kobe White and Zach LaVine. The only guys. Everybody else is new. But if you were to look at most teams over the course of a year and you had Vooch, DeRozan, Caruso, and Lonzo, like, that's pretty significant, particularly with LaVine. So from where I sat, I was like, okay, well, let's look at best case scenarios here. The Bulls realize that they don't have like a top five, even top 10 guy. We get that. But they do have a guy in LaVine that's young, who I think is a star. And everybody, I think, can admit he's at least a star. And they just got DeRozan, who's a guy that scores at the same level, actually even more efficiently from certain spots and certain, you know, play sets and ISOs and stuff like that. A guy that gets to the line more. That seems important. Not to mention that he's a real playmaker. He can get you 5-6 assists a game and has done that for the last couple of years. That seems meaningful, particularly with what I kept pointing out, that like LaVine developed really bad tunnel vision. I think each of the last 3 or 4 years, he'd had more turnovers, in some cases, like double the turnovers that he had assists in clutch moments. So that to me was relevant. And quite frankly, the fact, and I remember having this in a story and my editor kind of pulling it out, saying like, almost like one of those, if you're about to delete an important file, it's like, are you sure? My editor basically hit me with like an, are you sure? When I wrote my mag piece on the Bulls, where I basically said the Bulls had a chance to be really good on defense. And I mentioned like Lonzo and Caruso. And he was like, are you sure? Like that isn't that just two guys? And I was like, all right, fine, you're right. And then I took it out. And then the Bulls were like dominating in fourth quarters with Caruso and Lonzo, you know, playing small with these groups that were just flying around, taking the ball from everyone. I was like, damn, man. I should have just left that in the story. I could have looked smart. But again, like I, you know, my whole argument was that this team is probably going to be better than people realize on defense. Granted, I didn't see it being that Caruso and Lonzo would play together all the time, but I did figure that Caruso would be like an end of game lineup sort of person. And that really the guys on their team, like if you can figure out Vooch and he's not just getting assaulted at the rim on defense, you know, I don't know. DeRozan's bad, but you know, they might have enough defense to kind of make it work. And that's kind of what it was. So I feel really good about what I wrote about them. I feel really good about like the Hawks. I basically said that the Hawks were the team I was really, really didn't see how they were going to be better than they were last year or even as good. For a lot of the reasons I think we've seen is like role, I figured would be a real issue with these guys that want to get paid at some point. And now we've seen Cam Reddish be sent off for essentially nothing. So, you know, but the Bulls one, I think I felt really good about. I never imagined them being in first place. I figured, you know, maybe they can be a, you know, top of the East type team, but I never saw first place. Certainly halfway through the season, I never saw first place. So I have to take an L from that standpoint, but it's not as big a L as everybody else is taking.
Right, Nikias, right.
Yeah, you could add me to the L list. Like, I've talked about it on the pod before. During the offseason, someone asked me like, hey, what do you think the ceiling is for this Bulls team? I was like probably 6 seed for me. Cause like, I felt better about a few teams. Like most notably, I felt really good about Atlanta. That seems to be like a dud. Felt really good about Boston. I had M.A. Udoka as my coach of the year pick before the year.
I made that pick too. So I'll take that L with you. We can share an L.
There we go. And I even said it.
Did I just
like,
say we can share an L? Oh, God. Sorry.
We'll take it.
Remember what I said people were asking if I was on drugs? Sorry.
You're not beating the allegations. That's kind of tough. But, but no, like before the year, I was like, I see where the offense makes sense with DeRozan. I think Lonzo's going to help us connector and stuff. Like, I just didn't see it for the defense. And for the first month and a half, like Chicago's basically a top 5 defense. And I was like, well, if this is what they're going to be, I just have to take the L on that. To this point, they've been the best team in the East.
Yeah. Like I said, nobody saw that coming. And honestly, you know, when I talked to the Bulls before the season, you know, when I was working on the mag feature, I, you know, was essentially walking up to Zach LaVine and offering, like, I'll give you candy if you tell me what you think you guys are going to do this season. Nobody would take the bait. Him, DeRozan, Karnisovas, Billy Donovan. Like, nobody would set an expectation, let alone expectations. The idea that they, you know, I think that they, frankly, if I had to guess, I think they were hoping to make the playoffs with this group, you know. And if they can be like a five seed, if you told me before the season, you told them before the season, y'all are going to end up a five seed, I think they would have taken that in a heartbeat if we're being a, if we're keeping it a buck. One seed was never in the cards. And I still don't think they'll finish there. Who knows? Maybe. They have been really undermanned for a minute. I think most teams have gone through that. But like Caruso's missed pretty considerable time, just what, the last 3 weeks at least? It's been that long. Maybe longer. And Patrick Williams has been out since the first week of the season or whatever that was, maybe the second week of the season. LaVine's missed time. Everybody's had COVID on this roster, including Billy Donovan. So, you know, who knows? Like, I'm not sure. Even if they are the one seed, and I do think it, if they are like a one or a two seed, I think it raises a different question of, okay, we did not expect to be this good this quickly. Maybe we've benefited a little bit here from the fact that Brooklyn, you know, was not whole the whole season. Philly, you know, is feeling Ben Simmons fatigue or just, you know, has a little bit of a hole in their roster because they've got $35 million sucked up by this one dude that's not playing. Maybe it's that, you know, the Bucks are, you know, they're really, really good, but maybe guys will miss time or whatever. And certainly Drew and Chris Middleton missed time to start the season because they had played in the Olympics and Giannis missed some time just because they're going to rest these guys because they know that they can make it deep without having to be a one or a two seed. So maybe Chicago's benefiting from some of that. But even if they are, and even if they're just kind of higher in the standings than they should be, if you're a one or a two seed, how do you justify not going for it right now? Do you really think that you're going to have more runs left in you after this? You might, but like, it's not a wildly young team between Vooch and DeRozan. Granted, LaVine is young, but you kind of have to go for it, right? Like, if you're a one seed and you aren't going to trade Patrick Williams for something, I really like Patrick Williams. I know the Bulls do. So it's not saying like get rid of him. It's more saying, can you really afford not to? Like, you play to be a one seed in their position. And if you're not convinced at that point that you can make a run for it, I mean, the Bucks just won last year with, you know, I would say a team that was really not superior to Brooklyn. They essentially had one and a quarter of their three stars, and Milwaukee managed to kind of outlast them because of that, barely. But, you know, anything could happen. And if you're the Bulls, I think you have to at least put yourself in a position to be able to take advantage of whatever could happen, which like they've done to this point. But I think we can all look at them and look at, you know, granted, even with the injuries, even with COVID, they don't have anybody for, really anybody for KD, Giannis. A lot of teams don't have a great option for that. But without Patrick Williams, they don't have many guys that can even really touch them defensively. So I think that's their next step. But I really like what they've done. I never expected that they would be this good, and certainly not this quickly. But I thought that they maybe had the potential to be a top of the half, top half of the East team, not a one seed.
That was actually one of the questions I was going to ask you a little bit later, if you felt like the Bulls needed to go all in or if you think they just kind of hold serve and see how this team gels. You mentioned not having a guy like, hey, do you see anyone on the trade market that they should be targeting?
Well, I'll put it this way. I've been a little bit surprised that I haven't seen their name come up with the Jeremy Grant stuff. You've seen a lot of other teams that, you know, I think the Knicks were one of them. The Lakers were one of them. Can't remember who else was on the list, but, you know, I guess I don't know exactly what the trade market is for him. I imagine Patrick Williams would get you a conversation for just about anybody that's on the trade market that you would want at that position as like a four. I would say like a big, big small forward that can play a stretch four. You know, I think they should be open to it again. I don't know. It's always very interesting to project, but to me, if you could make a run at a Harrison Barnes, you could make a run at a Jeremy Grant, someone that doesn't have to have the ball, but can definitely score it. someone that can shoot it, someone that is big enough to defend, someone that is very unpleasant to defend in Giannis or KD. I'd at least have to consider that. And I just don't quite, you know, I don't know if anybody's saying like absolutely not and going like this and refusing to consider it, but I think you kind of have to, don't you? Like, what do you think?
I think honestly, with the year that DeRozan's having and just kind of where he is on the age, like it makes sense for him to kind of go in. Because my only other thing with, I think Patrick Williams is their primary chip. The only other thing is like, I think he gets you into room for a Jeremy Grant or Harrison Barnes. Like, is there like a true star that he gets you in the room with? Like that part, I'm not sure.
Not by himself. Exactly. Not by himself. And I think that's what it is like, cause even let's be real too. And I mean, I'd love your opinion and Steve's opinion on this. I'm also not sure that like hitting that person, it doesn't make you the favorite in my opinion in the East. I just think maybe it gives you a better shot in the East. I mean, they're going to be the one seed potentially and still not be the favorite, which that I've seen that happen before. It's not really a big thing, but like, I don't really see anybody on the trade market that's a realistic target for them that would make them the favorite. Until you have KD or Giannis, you're not going to be the favorite. Or unless you win like the next 35 games or something, you know, maybe you could, you know, it'd be interesting. Maybe you could be a favorite at that point. But no, I mean, they're not going to be. And even if you add Harrison Barnes, Jeremy Grant, I still don't think you are. But I think it makes your team potentially a lot better. This will be a horrible analogy, but like the same way that we keep talking about Ben Simmons, like, damn, like Philly doesn't get anything for the dude. There's just nothing. It's just a big slot on the roster that's just open. And it makes everybody worse. The Bulls have that right now. It's obviously very temporary because of, you know, Patrick Williams, and it's an injury, so he'll be back at some point, but he might not be back this season. And if that's the case, you're just getting no production from that spot, from his spot on the roster. If you could replace that with Jeremy Grant or Harrison Barnes and like a guy that just fits really well, I mean, I think you have to look at that. I would not love trading Patrick Williams. I don't think anybody would because he's good. What did he shoot as a rookie from three? Maybe I'm thinking about his corner 3-point percentage, but he shot very well. He's a big kid. I mean, he can do a little bit more. I think he's talented. He's skilled. I think he could be a really, really good defender just with the size and kind of the athleticism. So, no, you're not ever looking forward to training someone, but like at the same time, do you think at some point that he becomes better than Harrison Barnes? Does he become better than Jeremy Grant? And there's obviously a chance that he does. What is the likelihood that he does? And when does that happen? When does he blossom? And if it's not on the timeline that you've got DeRozan and Vooch on, if you want to know my honest opinion, I'm going to stop talking a bit because I've talked too much. The guy that seems like he doesn't fit all that well sometimes is Vooch. He's had a rough season. I don't know what you would get for him. And this was kind of my argument at the beginning, is that when I wrote that story earlier in the offseason, essentially when I compared them to the Hawks and the Suns from last year, it's like they don't have a superstar on this team. And a bunch of Bulls fans got real mad that I said that and wrote that. And it was like, the Bulls have the worst record in the league over the last 4 years. So you can't have a superstar and have the worst record in the league. You know, if you've got a superstar, like you're not capable of doing that if you've got a superstar. So I wasn't being disrespectful by saying that. Was more to say they have guys that I think you could realistically argue are all three guys that are in the top 40 of the league, maybe 35. But they're all like, they all probably rank like anywhere from 20 to 35 or 40. They're not top 10 guys. They're not even necessarily top 15 guys. And so if you've got three guys in that range, can you make up for the lack of a superstar with like a trio of smaller level stars that are legit stars, certainly two of them, and then Vooch, like whatever you consider him to be, and he's been an all-star before. I think he's down a notch, and I think that what his skill set is different from everybody else's, but if he's not knocking down quite enough threes and quite enough long-range shots, he just kind of, maybe it's because they've got two scoring guards, he just kind of seems like he's there sometimes, it's been a while since I've looked at him and really thought that, especially after those Orlando years. But that's somebody that, like, I don't know that you could, I don't know what his contract situation is. But just thinking about it, I was like, there are times where I watch him and I'm like, he just kind of is real quiet sometimes. And maybe if you wanted to develop an advantage for the playoffs, you would need someone to replace his size. But if you got someone that was a lot more versatile, or you kind of were able to play even faster with some of those groups that Lonzo and Caruso have, it'd be interesting to me. It's not going to happen, but I'm just kind of like, like everybody assumes it's Patrick Williams, and it probably will be if they make a move. But Vooch hasn't been a great season for him so far. He's had moments, but it hasn't been a great season for him at all.
I like it. This was one of my questions I was going to ask. And so I'll go into counter Steve mode, because Vooch's stats aren't what Vooch brings to the table. But you can make the argument, in a sense, he's having a little bit more of a complete year as far as holding up whatever he's asked to do defensively and being a connective part offensively, as far as, hey, I can space, I can run these dribble handoffs, I open things up with LaVine, but he's not bringing the Vooch finishing touch to it. There's not the same post-ups, not the same threes. So it's like he's doing more of this without just like the ice cream on top.
He's the guy sacrificing. He's sacrificing, yes, compared to everybody else. I got you. Yeah.
So it's kind of like this weird dynamic where I watch Vooch and it's like, I see what he's doing for this team, but he's also not hitting all the home runs on top of it. So it seems like, dang, he's really kind of holding them back. But I've liked, like, he's held up better defensively than I thought he would at this stage.
He has.
As far as consistency.
He absolutely has. Here's my thing, though. Because I also think we look at it relative to like what we're used to seeing from Vooch, right? So what I'm doing is probably like maybe a little bit harsh on Vooch statistically. And what you're doing is saying like, he's holding up better and more connectively than I thought he would defensively, given what he's done and what the way he's looked in the past for this group. My question, though, is that if we're kind of judging him on like that sort of scale, does that hold up in the playoffs? Because I'm not convinced that. Part of me kind of feels like, even given what we've seen this year, when the playoffs come, that I won't go as far as to say he'll be a liability defensively, but I was really interested and really intrigued by the idea of seeing Patrick Williams be able to play the five at times for them defensively and making them a little bit quicker. And I just wonder, I don't know, maybe it's not fair given that they've had some really good game-ending lineups with Vooch, with the other guys. Maybe it just doesn't work the same way when you don't have Caruso. Like, even when they went on that 9-game winning streak over the last couple of weeks before Dallas beat them, the defense wasn't what it had been when Caruso was there just making a frenzy for everybody with Lonzo. So it might not even be that it's him, but I just think they have to be whole. And it's been so long since they have been. And the flaws really show in a way that they're not supposed to when they're not whole. And we knew going into the season that their depth was not going to be a strength.
I'm with you. And the funny part is, either way we look at it, I think we both agree, the Bulls don't hit their ceiling if Vooch doesn't add more.
I get you. Exactly. That's exactly my point.
Mm-hmm. So I'm with you on that. They won't be as good as they could be if he doesn't add more as far as shot making goes. So you can't just be this in the playoffs. I'll give you that. The interesting part, because we talk about Harrison Barnes, we talk about Jeremy Grant, and I wonder, Bulls are an interesting spot, right? So all the moves they've made have opened this window up for them. But they've also found things, whether it's AO or whether it's other guys stepping up, next man up. And they like to put Alex Caruso on everybody. So at some point, do they just hold on to what they have and say, hey, you know what? Let's wait a minute, because Caruso will come back and he'll just be the fifth in our lineup and we'll figure it out. Or do they push all their chips in and say, nah, let's get Jeremy Grant, but now Caruso's on the bench? Like, that part is interesting to me as far as team building goes, because they have loved them some Alex Caruso.
They have. And
I've seen that man guard.
Kyle's been really good too.
Every man. That too, he's stepped
Caruso, up. So all Caruso's got to do, man, is go to New York, and he have the top three markets in the league covered. And I mean, he's going to start getting MVP votes. You know, it's funny, like when I used to watch college football, they'd always talk about how the West Coast players didn't get the Heisman because certain people don't see their games because people on the East Coast are too sleepy. by the time the West Coast games get played at night. But Caruso's going to have all the area codes covered, the zip codes covered, and all the regions covered. Like, he's going to start getting MVP votes pretty soon. If he goes to the Knicks, man, it's over. It's all the way over. He's going to be the favorite player in the league, the most popular player in the league. But no, in all seriousness, you're right. I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that when they're more whole, and this is what I'm saying about Vooch, playing smaller, it almost feels like you want to see how small can they go and make it work, because they can just run teams ragged. But Vooch has to add the shot making to make teams pay to actually make the full use of his value, because the spacing is nice, but also he plays in a team that has good passers on him. So DeRozan will find him. Lonzo certainly will find him. Caruso will find him. And LaVine, I think, you know, a lot of the passes he's making are just looking for the most open guy, and he will throw that pass too. But I don't know. If I'll put it this way, his role was completely different in Orlando. I think that there would have been more synergy last year had he been able to play more with Zach. Zach missed a whole bunch of time towards the end of the year. It's always a lot harder when you're asking someone to go from like a number one to a number three. And, you know, Bosch struggled with that initially and kind of being put into that role. And I think there's not enough of an appreciation for that Vooch went from being a number one a little bit less than a half of a season to like a number two essentially with Zach. And then, you know, this year is essentially a number three. And even with that, Lonzo's got the ball in his hands a lot too, because he's the point guard. So, you know, he's still the third most important guy in their offense, but you've got Lonzo shooting the ball more confidently, and he's just looking to pass, you know, so, and he's a point guard, so he's going to have the ball a lot. So there are times where Vooch kind of is the last guy to touch it. And maybe it's harder to get a rhythm that way. Maybe he's still just kind of getting used to everything. He missed time with COVID as well. But to me, it doesn't even feel like they're really a true, true contender with him not being his best self, because they already kind of seem short something. If it's a power forward, if it's another scorer, if it's that their rotation just isn't deep enough. But Vooch has to be better for them to have a chance of really winning the East. I just kind of feel like all the other teams in the East are going to get better. You look at Miami and where they are at. You look at Brooklyn and the fact that they've been able to do this without their whole roster, without their stars all together all this time. And Milwaukee's not going nowhere. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
The East is fun, man. They all got 27 wins right now.
The East is fun. Let me bug Steve, and then I want to ask Steve a question. One, the middle ground between staying pat and pushing all the chips in for like a Harrison Barnes or a Jeremy Grant is the trade for Kenrich Williams. Like, I think that could solve a lot of. I just want to see what this reaction is going to be. Kenrich is good, by the way. We'll, you know, we run part 37 of that podcast if you want to. On a more serious note, to the Vooch conversation, it is interesting in which he's had to scale down on offense while scaling up on defense, just because they do ask him to play a lot higher than he's accustomed to in Orlando. So, like, that's been an interesting dynamic. And to both of your points, he has held up a little bit better than I anticipated. Again, I've just been flat out wrong about Chicago's defense, so that just kind of goes with it. So, Steve, I'll ask you, like, is there a way that you could see Chicago incorporating him a little bit better offensively? Not necessarily in that they're doing a bad job now, but like in terms of him establishing a rhythm, sort of shot making, is there? Do you think there's anything?
It's tricky because he is a focal point of what they do as far as screening and handoffs. So he starts a lot of sets. He's a big screener, but he pops a lot. So you could run actions to maybe get him in an empty side, empty corner. But then again, he might just pop. And if he doesn't have the jumper going, you're in the same boat. Also, he's being unselfish almost to a degree where he might pass up a look to go to a handoff or hit someone rolling. So it's that part you kind of really can't coach up. The number one thing you would probably say on paper is to stagger the lineups, but you're already staggering the lineups. And I don't know if him plus the bench really helps anyone. especially with the way DeMar's playing, especially with the way Zach's playing. So depending on how you go that way, there's not really a ready-made group for him to go out there and just say, hey, Vooch, go post up five times in a row. We got spacing. Get in rhythm and then see how you can build out from there. So I guess potentially maybe getting him some more touches earlier in games, especially maybe if LaVine is out, run a couple screens for him to start the game. You can always get DeMar going, see if you can get him in a flow and then continue to run your rhythm. The problem is Chicago's at their best offensively when everyone's kind of involved. So like my concern in the preseason was this would be way too much your turn, my turn. As far as LaVine does something, now DeMar does something, now Vooch does something, and they've fixed that. But in fixing that, you've kind of opened up a position where those guys have a bigger chance into a rhythm than him. But you need him to get those guys in rhythm. Like it's an odd yin yang type deal. So it's more so right. Just kind of trying to find pockets to get him in rhythm and make sure he stays aggressive. That's the biggest thing. So regardless of if he makes or not, we know that they won't hit their ceiling if he doesn't. But if he gets passive at any point in time, then they're really in trouble.
Right.
Because now you have a guy who's supposed to unlock things for you and does with LaVine. But if he's not going to make the shot and make defenses pay, you got an issue. So, I mean, shoot, if you get him switched on a certain guy, throw it to him in the post. Give him a couple of those and mash those guys. We see Kevin Love make a living on it this season off the bench. Just, hey, you guys are small and you're switching on me. I'll figure it out. So there's ways to kind of open things up for him, but it's hard to just kind of game plan it just with what Chicago's trying to do.
It makes sense. Is that positive enough or is that... Well, I just want to make sure that we...
Is makes sense the new fair enough? I got you.
I can't win at all. Jesus. All right, Chris, I have a question for you. The projecting for, we don't know where Chicago's going to end up seeding wise right now, obviously. But which team in the top four do you think they would have an easier time with in the postseason? Or who would they prefer to play?
Let me pull up. Meaning the current top four?
Yeah.
Or the teams that we perceive that will be there, which I imagine Milwaukee, Brooklyn. Like, who are you considering here? Because, well, you definitely don't mean the current top four because you're not. Otherwise, I say, well, Cleveland. I think maybe they take the chance with Cleveland. So you're talking about Milwaukee, Brooklyn. Who's your fourth team that you're considering here? Miami?
Yeah, Miami.
Since they're tied for first with Miami? Okay. That's a really good question. And also, like, is there any team you would take them over with that? You know, with their current roster versus those. This is why I just don't see them as a favorite because, like, I don't know who I would take them over in that group. Are we assuming, too, that all three of those other teams are at full strength? Or are we kind of taking into account that, like, some of them are kind of more banged up or injury prone or unvaccinated to some degree compared to other teams?
I was going to say one of them is going to be at two-thirds strength.
Right.
I guess we go for the latter, I suppose. I mean, Brooklyn is just going to have the asterisk regardless.
Right. I mean, but even then, I mean, like if Durant's playing, that's just a really brutal matchup for them. I mean, I don't like it. I don't know. I was about to say Miami, but I don't really believe that either. Like, they've got a lot of grittiness to that team. They've got more scorers on that team than they have. I'll say Brooklyn, but I don't feel good about it at all. I mean, it's rooted in, like, maybe Kyrie doesn't get the shot. And Brooklyn relies on a lot of young guys. Like, they've got some vets in their rotation, too. So it's not a knock. But I mean, I don't feel good about that pick at all. Like, in saying which, and I'm sure they don't prefer to play them. They just beat the brakes off them, like, a week ago. Now, granted, like, the Bulls had everybody out. Was it Derrick Jones Jr. that got hurt, like,
first,
10 seconds into the game? So, I mean, I fully understand that they didn't have the guys that would be most effective at trying to stop Durant. So I'm fully aware of that. But also, like, that was the worst game I've ever seen in my life. Like, it was just the Bulls looked really listless during that game. And, you know, at least in the third quarter of that game when they just got smoked. So I know they've beaten – Brooklyn twice this year too, so I'm aware of that. But like, I just don't I don't know if there's anybody that can go into that series feeling really good, but I don't know that you would feel really good against Miami. And Milwaukee's Milwaukee. Like, maybe they could make it a little bit challenging for them, but I would take Milwaukee over the Bulls too. So that's what I'm saying. Like, even if you go get Harrison Barnes, you go get Jeremy Grant, I don't think they become favorites. Maybe they become, I think if, from a betting standpoint, some people might take them over the Heat, but I don't see anybody taking them over the Nets or the Bucks, even with Jeremy Grant or even with Harrison Barnes. I just don't. And that doesn't dictate the way I think, but I just think that they're not the favorite right now, which normally you cannot say that about a one seed more than halfway through the season. It's weird. It's a very strange year.
I'm going to go left here and make Mekhi's mad because he said Kenrich Williams.
Okay.
I'm going to attempt to at least. So the Brooklyn deal on paper, maybe you could talk your way into it, but if their offense goes right, I don't think they can keep up. Miami, you can probably bog them down on the other end, but they might just play zone and they have all those defenders now. So I don't like that one as much. I'm going to say Milwaukee.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
I'm going to say you can DeMar and LaVine your way and bog it down and hopefully get Milwaukee in some sort of slugfest and find a lineup to beat them. This is based in theory and trying to just annoy Nekias, but DeRozan and LaVine have the types of games that may not be as bothered by the non-Giannis defenders. No offense to Drew Holiday, who's tremendous. But that's a post up. Milton got to deal with it. Maybe they can slow it down. Maybe the Bucks get in their own way, trip over themselves a couple times. Bulls and six. You never know.
Bulls and six.
Okay, so it didn't work, first and foremost.
I said I was giving an attempt. I'm trying to get a shot up at the end of the buzzer, man. You can't just hold the ball.
I respect the attempt. I'm here for you doing a game thread during that series, and we get the the Caruso defending Giannis possession, in which Giannis tries to spin and Caruso, just snatches the ball, draws a foul after that. And that'll happen. But in a series, I can't say I see it. Like, even if they were to get a Jeremy Grant or Harrison Barnes, they just don't have a body for Giannis. And I don't know. It hasn't felt like a bunch of Milwaukee getting in their own way in the half court this year, at least compared to last year, which is a positive for me. I'm also just super high on Milwaukee. So, that.
It's always a possibility, my friend.
That's true.
It'll be good to see the Bulls back in the playoffs, though. I mean, it sounds reductionist to do that to them when they're one seed. But, getting through a round and making the playoffs, assuming that they can do that. And if they can give somebody a good... I mean, I know they're not going to think about it that way if they're the one seed, but it's the league. I don't know. I hate it because I don't think I'm overly biased, but I do think there's something good about the league when the big markets are in the game and relevant. It kind of is weird. Think about how much we enjoy Twitter when certain fan bases are alive, maybe even when they get a little bit too arrogant. It's fun. It's just fun. And watching the Knicks make the playoffs last year was fun. I was not a fan of the whole let's spit on Trae Young thing. That was disgusting and nasty. But generally speaking, though, that, even with a bad playoff performance, that fan base was on fire. And that was what I wrote that story about, just saying, I don't think it will take much to get Bulls fans back in gear, even after all these years of being irrelevant. And they're selling games out, not just against the Warriors and teams like that, but they're selling games out. Their season tickets are sold out for the year now. But that's even more of a reason that it's an interesting spot for them to be in, because you can go all in, but the idea of going all in when you have already kind of done that, you went out and got Vooch and then you went out and got DeRozan, that's pretty all in, especially by this standard. If you go in again, do you substantially raise the team's ceiling, and who does it make you a favorite over those, those teams we were just talking about? Because I don't know that it does. Again, I definitely not Milwaukee, definitely not Brooklyn in my mind, but if you're a one seed and you're not going for it, I don't quite understand what the purpose of your season is either. Because you never would have imagined this. And now that you have it, you're just not going to gamble.
No, I feel that. To the Knicks, Hawks point. Yeah, that the Trae Young thing was weird. Did not know the Knicks had Michael Todd in attendance, so that's cool. But beyond that, we're having a second round conversation about the Chicago Bulls. Like, that's just not a thing that I anticipated heading into the year. Like, it's a testament to them. To answer my own question, like, I think if I had to power rank it, it's probably Brooklyn, Miami, Milwaukee for me in terms of who the Bulls would want to see.
Brooklyn first.
I'd say Brooklyn first. Like, they may be out of a guy. And then also, like, I don't have particularly strong feelings about Brooklyn's defense. I'll put it that way. And so you kind of talk yourself into a shot maker's ball. But I mean, even then, like, I would have Brooklyn favored in that series. But, like, I guess that would be the pathway for me. And then
we're going to mm-hmm. disrespect DeAndre Bembry.
I, of all That's people, am not going to disrespect DeAndre Bembry. You're not about to try to flip that on me. Absolutely not. I won't stand for that. No. Love Bembry and Claxton Hive is alive. No. Unfortunately, those can't be your only two. Anyway, we're not getting into that. Miami, like, I'm always kind of worried about what the half court creation is like for them when games get further bogged down. And the Bulls do have tough shot makers. They have DeRozan, they have LaVine, they do have Vooch. Like, in theory, that gives you an inside out threat. And with Miami, it's a lot of relying on Jimmy Butler to get to the free throw line. And it's a lot, you know, Tyler Hero knocking down tough jumpers who he's taking a step this year. But if we're just playing that game, just lining up who you trust to knock down tough shots at the end of games, like, Chicago probably has two of the top three guys on the list. So there's the path. And I just don't really see it with Milwaukee. Like, Giannis is just such a, one, I just think they're a better team. But beyond that, Giannis is such a singular force that the Bulls just don't have a real answer for. It's just kind of tough sledding from there for me.
Yeah, I don't think they're beating Milwaukee. I just, I mean, Milwaukee, people sleep too. I think because they've been so banged up all year and, you know, and even when they're not banged up, just resting guys, that team is really, really full as far as just the depth. And they're still not even at full strength yet. So I don't know. I'm not trying to play Milwaukee. It's crazy to think that, like, I'm thinking about all the player ranking things that had Durant ahead of Giannis this year, including the one from my shop at Sports Illustrated. I didn't vote for KD. I voted for Giannis. I was the only one on the basketball staff that did that. But it's crazy because, thank you, because, you know, I've always had questions now, at least for the last several years, about KD's health. Even if he could make it through a season, you know, he might have to miss a chunk of it. Now they're saying that. But I mean, Milwaukee, if you're concerned that Brooklyn maybe doesn't always have the depth, particularly when they have a expensive player that sits out home games, you don't have that problem with Milwaukee when they're healthy. Certainly when they're completely healthy. I just don't want anything to do with them. I don't want to play them. The confidence that they'll have, I feel like at that point you're banking on Middleton not being consistent or maybe Giannis getting hurt or something, which I just don't want anything to do with Milwaukee compared to I would take my chance with Brooklyn first. And Miami, some of the offensive stagnation you were talking about. But Milwaukee, I just kind of, to me, that's who I would have picked coming out of the East before the season, who I did pick. So, yeah. I don't want that if I'm the Bulls at all. It seems like a nightmare matchup.
Yeah, that's just kind of tough. I kind of hate to ended here because, like, the Bulls have been really good. And it's just like, all right, cool. We just don't have any faith in them to make
a great start, guys. Great surprise. Yeah,
let's say this. I'll say this. The trade market, they need to make use of. I mean, I'm beating around the bush with it. They need to make use of it. No one wants to see it be Patrick Williams. But he can't help you. Maybe he can't help you at all this year. Or if he can, it might not be till the playoffs, at which point he'd be rested anyway. So you need to do something on the trade market. He's really the only thing you've got that would fetch you something, unless you're dealing Kobe White, which I don't even know what that would get you. I'm not sure. Like, he certainly has some skill. They could do that, but also for the first time in a while, they might be appealing to someone on a buyout market, which I feel like we generally think about the LAs and the Miamis or the team that just won a title in the Milwaukees. Chicago could be relevant in that conversation in a way that they normally aren't. So I'm not, you know, I'm not going to give up on it completely. I just kind of feel like it's very clear they need some upgrades. It's very clear they need some sort of juice that they don't have, and some size that they don't have. And so we'll see if they can find a way to get some of what they need, then maybe, you know, and then it's a different conversation. So that's my glass. I don't know how full this is. It's more than half full, but I'll pour something in there for them. Because I, like you said, that's the team that I thought would be good that everybody else is hating on. And they've been better than I could have expected. But it does kind of feel like it's starting to get into that. Well, they just came off a 9-game win streak and it was still kind of like, well, it just doesn't feel completely real to me at a certain point. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Kind of like the Cleveland phenomenon, to where like there were some people that were like, okay, this could be a play-in team. Like, I think people are being a little bit too low on them. And then they just come out the gates and they're just top four all year long. It's like, okay, wait, I can't even.
Best net rating.
There you go. Best net rating in the East.
Are they about to finish outside of home court advantage range despite having the best net rating in the East? Although Miami is kind of coming for them in that regard now. But we'll see.
It would be kind of tough to talk about a team that needs to utilize the trade market if they're serious about making some kind of push this year. Like, Cleveland needs...
They lost some point guards, yeah, for sure.
They're going to need to get a guard in the room.
Yeah. But I hated that Rubio injury. Not that I didn't hate Sexton's, too. But good point.
Were you about to say something, Steve?
Oh, no, I was going to make a Rondo joke, but...
Oh, no.
I'll pass.
So will he. There we go.
Man, that might have been my cue.
See, there we go. Once again, go out stores, order online, get Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. Support Chris Herring and all that he does. He's fantastic at what he does. Even better person. Check it out if you have not already. You can follow him on Twitter at Herring_NBA. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.